This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Neil Young's early records are played on classic rock stations, but he doesn't have to get by on nostalgia, and his music hasn't frozen in the past. Some of his recent music has been too adventurous and raw to get airplay on anything but college stations. Young is also eccentric and sometimes controversial. A few years ago, his video This Note's For You, a send-up of musicians who do beer and soda commercials, was banned by MTV and then went on to win their Video of the Year award. Young grew up in Canada. When he moved to L.A., he met Stephen Stills, and they formed Buffalo Springfield. He later sang with Stills in Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. Young has also led his own rock band, Crazy Horse. Neil Young's latest album, Harvest Moon, is his most popular record in recent years. He just performed a concert on MTV's Unplugged, and that's inspired us to replay this interview, which we recorded when the album was released last November. This is the title track, Harvest Moon.
Come a little bit closer, hear what I have to say. Just like children sleeping, we could dream this night away. But there's a full moon rising, let's go dancing in the light. We know where the music's playing, let's go out and feel the night. Because I'm still in love with you, I wanna see
Neil Young, welcome to Fresh Air. What's the relation of the new album Harvest Moon to your earlier album Harvest?
Well, really, when I started making Harvest Moon, it was just a few songs, and I had four or five songs, so I had enough to do a session. And then I chose the musicians for the session based on those songs. And when I saw the list, I recognized it as the same people that I'd used on Harvest. And then, during the process of that, of course, we realized what we sounded like, and it sounded, like the original record that we made a long time ago, but 20 years difference, you know.
It's interesting that you're returning, in a way, to an earlier style, especially after your recent live albums like Arc and Weld, which were really loud and filled with feedback and, lots of, noise, interesting stuff, but very different than what you're doing now.
Well, this is really just a form of music that I return to, and it's evolving. It's more evolved this time than it was the last time I returned to it, so I figure the same thing will happen on the other side with the grungier things that I've been doing with my electric music. When I come back to that in the future someday, I imagine I'll just take off from where I was the last time I was there, you know?
A few years ago on My, My, Hey, Hey, you sung that it's better to burn out than fade away. Do you still feel that way?
Well, as far as what I do, I think it's better that I do it as hard as I can and then either stop or, for whatever reason, not do it anymore. But to just let the energy kind of die is... that's not what I want to do. So that's what I'm talking about with that phrase there.
What's your idea of burning out? I mean, what are some of the things that you feel you've done that risked getting you to a point of burnout, but meant?
Well, I think
not
almost everything
away.
I've done that. a lot of the things I've done have gotten me to that point. That's why I get that far, and then instead of continuing and letting the energy slide away, I just stop and do something else rather than, just kind of let the thing lose its intensity and kind of back down.
Is that where you are with this album? Was this album a kind of stopping after the more hard sound of Ark and Well?
After the last three or four albums, which have been had a lot of distortion and a lot of loud sounds and everything, I kind of felt like, you know, especially after the experience of playing the Ragged Glory tour, which produced the last live album, after the experience of doing that and playing during the Persian Gulf War and playing at exceedingly loud levels with really bombastic and kind of violent-sounding, explosive waves of grunge, you know, all this stuff. And kind of standing in the middle of that wondering whether I was going to get blown over or whatever, you know, after doing it for 90 nights or whatever we did it, 90 days anyway. I was just at a point where I wanted to kind of go the other way and play as quiet as I could and just play something really soothing and really easy to physically handle. Not so much in any mental release, but the physicalness of listening to something real soft. So that's what I was looking for there, and I made sure we all played as quiet as possible in the studio, so you could almost have a conversation over any of the tracks that we were playing when we were playing them. We weren't trying to be powerful in the sense of loud. We were just real quiet.
You know, it's interesting, most of the people who play, you know, that kind of like loud grunge sound are much younger, and I wonder how you felt as somebody in his 40s who's been recording since the mid-60s, playing a music that mostly people who are, you know, a generation or so younger than you.
None of these old guys around know how to do it.
No, the old guys know how to do it?
No, they don't. They can't do it, so, you know, they don't do it. That's why I'm still doing it, because I know how. If they were as lucky as me, they'd be doing it too. I mean, it's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
There's no sensation like that.
What does it feel like?
Feels great. I mean, you're in the middle of this thing. It's all around you. It surrounds you. It's an amazing sound. You know, grunge started before I started playing. I mean, Link Wray started. He was one of the earliest of the of this type of music with a song called Rumble.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember.
And several other songs. And he combined with Lonnie Mack, who did Wham and Memphis back in the early 60s. That was the beginning of this stuff.
You were in high school bands. Did you sing in those bands?
After the beginning, I did. I started as an instrumentalist. We used to do songs, instrumentals that I used to write, you know, melodies and play them on a guitar, sort of like a group called The Shadows from England. And then after the English invasion, you know, and the... and also about the same time as Jimmy Reed became popular, the old blues man Jimmy Reed with going to New York and...
Bright Lights, Big City.
Yeah, Beeping and Hiding, all these things. You know, about the same time as the British invasion, all these groups singing harmony and playing guitars and everything. Both of those things happened to me at once, so I really couldn't figure out who it was that made me want to sing, but one of them... you know, or both of them at the same time. And I started singing, and that was like a milestone.
What do you mean?
People couldn't believe it, apparently. I don't remember it, but I was so into it, I guess I didn't notice that everybody was going, what is that? You know, as I was starting to sing. Of course, now I'm like, you know, Caruso or something. Got it down.
Were you self-conscious about your voice when you started to sing?
No, not really. I never really, I was just glad to be singing. I mean, we could do a lot more songs if I sang them.
No one else in the band could sing?
No. Nobody in the band could sing. Not nobody else in the band. Nobody in the band. So we did harmony, and we did everything, you know, but it didn't matter.
Now, you say that you weren't self-conscious about your singing, but there are stories about how, you know, like in your first solo album, you intentionally mixed yourself in the background.
No, I mixed myself right up there where I should be, and then they tried out this new scientific process that they'd invented called the CSG Heiko-Cog process, which is this unbelievable thing where you can make a stereo record play back on a mono machine just like it was a mono record. They did something to the sound back then. This is when stereo was just coming out. Mm-hmm. And they were, you know, a lot of people had mono sets, and the stereo didn't sound right on the mono set. So this, they came out with this thing. You run it through this machine that this guy made, this little box or something, and it would make it so you could play it both stereo or mono. But in reality, I was a test case for this with my first album. They did this without letting me know. And they put it out like that, and I got the pressings back, and I went, what happened, you know? Then I read this thing that had been added on the album cover where this, with this engineering note that this had employed this technique. And really, it was the worst thing I ever heard. I mean, they just buried the whole center of the record and put it way down. And this, I think they only used it on my record. They decided it didn't work after that.
So it wasn't self-consciousness that was behind
it? No. That'll be the next record. My vocal is right up there.
Mm-hmm. How did you feel about being in a tight harmony group like Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young?
How did they feel about it? That's the question. It was no longer a tight harmony group.
Do you like being in a harmony like that? I mean, I love your voice. I consider it a very personal voice. Do you know what I mean? A voice that should be singing on its own more so than just like mixed in a harmony.
Well, you know, I like singing harmony too. I sing good harmony with Crazy Horse.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a sense in there that, you know, because there's a couple of different ways to sing harmony, you know, and you can, or blends of all of them. But one of them is just real tight harmony, and the other one is where everybody's singing just more or less just singing loose, but in a harmonic structure with a lot of feeling. That's a different kind of harmony, and that's the kind of harmony that I do with Crazy Horse quite a bit. Sometimes we're real successful at that.
My guest is Neil Young. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Neil Young, if you're just joining us. And he, by the way, has a new album called Harvest Moon. So you came from Canada to Los Angeles, became part of Buffalo Springfield, and I guess it was in 66, you have a really big hit, For What It's Worth. And then, you know, people just like love Buffalo Springfield. This is like the height or the beginnings of the height of the whole kind of counterculture, which is really thriving, particularly on the West Coast. And so suddenly, like, you're really in the thick of it. I mean, you'd gone from what, a small town in Canada, right?
Yeah, it's kind of half a million people, something like that.
Uh-huh. And now, like, you're really in the thick of it. Did you change a lot? Were you, like, a kind of different person than you were?
Well, you know, I think it affected me. I think it got to be a lot of pressure for a while. But, you know, we got through that after freaking out and quitting the band a couple of times and, you know, throwing my guitar against the chair and doing all kinds of stuff. You know, we went through a normal kind of teenage to adult changeover period there.
When you throw your guitar against the chair, do you? In the days when you did that, was it? Were you sure you had money to replace it?
No, that was
the
point.
Before you threw it?
No. No, I think I didn't do that every day, but it's just part. I guess the pressure of being in the band and trying to make things happen. Yeah. We did a lot of things like that. I mean, what, we were 20, 21 years old. We were kind of crazy for a while, and then, you know, just like anybody else under a lot of pressure. Bunch of kids, and, you know, it was a pretty fast-moving time.
What's something that you look back on and still find really exciting about that period?
Well, the music was great, and it's too bad it was never recorded correctly, or, you know, the Buffalo Springfield would have been far more of a memory than they are now.
What's missing?
The music is missing. There was, you know, this was about the time when people started making records by overdubbing, and new technology was coming in. We had like 8 tracks, and you know, big. We had ways of doing things that weren't that made it possible to layer records. And so instead of going in the studio and singing live, like we were so great live, the people producing us, they didn't record us the way they should have. If they had just set us up and let us record live, this band would be, band probably would have been together and stayed together a lot longer, because we would have had much more success and had a lot more happiness from listening to our records and, you know, felt like we were getting something done. But at the beginning, it was kind of hard to break through. We still didn't know how to make records, and we didn't have anybody that knew how to make records helping us make records. And instead we had people who wanted to be record producers for, you know, for one reason or another, who were there, but they really weren't doing anything. Nobody strong came along and said, listen, you guys go in there and sing, and when I tell you to come out and stop playing and singing, then come on in here and it'll sound great. Nobody ever did that. So I feel that was a failing of the Buffalo Springfield, was all the records. There was only Ahmed Erdogan really had a grip on what should be, what the Springfield records should sound like.
What sounds best to you now from those records?
I don't have a favorite.
Okay. I thought I'd play Mr. Soul. What are your memories of that?
Well, the memories of that are the best take of it and the best mix of it and the best version of it is somewhere in the Atlantic vault.
Right.
And the one that we're listening to here is one that where we got away from it and we kept overdubbing and overdubbed guitar parts and added things over top of the original stuff and lost some of the original stuff. And we took it too far. We didn't have anybody to tell us to go home or tell us that had experience telling us what to do. So we lost a lot of the great stuff that we had on tape in the first place, or that we never got a lot of it on tape at all.
Okay. Well, in the meantime, we'll satisfy ourselves with the actually released version of Mr. Soul. Your song The Needle and the Damage Done, which is also from the Harvest album, was written for Danny Whitten, who was the guitarist in Crazy Horse, and he had overdosed. What was the impact of you on that, of his death?
Well, you know, I think everybody was devastated by it, everybody in the band, and we were all... you know, we all felt very sad. It was a great loss to us. So, you know, we managed to turn it into music. That's all we can do with it.
Right. I want to play the song Tonight's the Night. Would you say something about writing this and what you were thinking about during this period?
I really don't remember what I was thinking about during the period. I know that the stuff all came out real fast and that I was immersed in this thing. It had stayed inside me for a while. It had been, what did we do? We did Tonight's the Night right after Time Fades Away. Time Fades Away was the tour that Danny was rehearsing for and then didn't go. So, he didn't go on the tour. He went somewhere else. So, you know, this was sort of like a wake or something, I guess, the Tonight's the Night record, because the people that I played it with were the people that we played with Danny, and Danny knew, and we were all his friends. It was just one of those moments, you know, we just went for it.
This is Neil Young.
A sparkle was in his eye, but his life was in his hand. Well, late at night when the people were gone, he used to pick up my guitar and sing a song in a shaky voice.
that was real as the day was long. Tonight's the night, yes it is. Tonight's the night. Tonight's the night, yes it is. Tonight's the night. Early in the morning at the break of...
Neil Young is my guest, and that's Tonight's the Night. Neil Young has a new album called Harvest Moon. And I know you have two sons who have cerebral palsy. Your doctors have said that it's not related and that it's just one of the most incredible coincidences. Have you ever found out anything about that?
Well, my life has been a series of incredible coincidences and extreme things that have happened to me. So I feel, I'm lucky to get where I am and everything. You know, my life's been funny like that, so...
What else strikes you as being that extreme or coincidental?
Just the whole thing. You know, I can't go into detail, but look where I am now. I mean, I started off where hundreds of thousands of other kids started off, you know.
You mean just in high school bands?
Yeah. Now a lot of them are working in department stores. I mean, you know, I don't, you know, it's been an unusual life for me. I'm very happy that things worked out the way they have.
Neil Young. Our interview was recorded last November. His latest album is Harvest Moon. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.